Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Jimmy Murchison, CEO of Hatch Resources, who walks through buying in the Permian over the last 3 years and breaks down their $290 million exit to Kimball Royalty Partners back in October 2022. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Jimmy had to say.
All right, Jimmy, good afternoon and welcome back on the podcast. Good to have you back. I've been having a bunch of reunion episodes recently, and 3 years to the date is kind of the theme. So it's been a little under 3 years, but you were on in October 2020. So looking to get an update, looking forward to it.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim, for having me on. Lots has changed, obviously, since we last talked in almost 3 years ago. But happy to be back here and you still you're promoting the minerals business and giving us a platform to talk about an asset class we love.
Well, we're not going to go into excruciating detail, but a little refresher for those who aren't familiar. What's the Hatch story? When was it founded? Your financial partners, strategy, over to you.
Sure. Yeah, no, happy to give you a little bit of refresher. Be a very similar story from when I was on last, but you know, Hatch got started formally with Ridgemont Equity Partners with a $200 million equity commitment in January of 2019. We put the team together really in summer and late of 2018. And when we formally got backed, it was to pursue minerals and an operating strategy out in the Permian Basin. The operating environment we saw as deteriorating very quickly after we formally got backed, and we pivoted to minerals. We were very cautious when we pivoted into minerals. We had a view that it was too expensive and too competitive. I'd never bought a kind of a mineral anchor in my life prior to starting Hatch. And so we were really designed to be a BD effort, putting together leases and drilling wells. So we put together a plan on how we thought we should buy minerals, and we started transacting, and we were very happy with the quality of the deals that we're getting. The underwriting made sense. And so we quickly changed our mind from minerals being too expensive and too competitive to a space that we wanted to commit, you know, the rest of our capital to and 100% of our time. So glad we did. So bought very heavily in 2019 and then still buying today on gas minerals. But late last year, we announced a transaction where we sold a big chunk of our position on an asset sale to Kimball Royalty Partners. And that closed December 15th of 2022.
Awesome. Now, originally, you guys were Delaware, pretty rifle shot. You've since expanded to the Midland. You've done some stuff in the renewables royalty space. I'll hand it over to you. Since you were last on, talk about the evolution of the strategy and some of the bolt-ons that you guys have, you know, brought under the umbrella.
Yeah, well, I'll start with, since you mentioned the solar royalties idea. So we have two Hatch entities. We have the Hatch Resources entity where we're actively buying oil and gas minerals. And we have another entity we started called Hatch Renewables. It's also backed by Ridgemont, but completely separate entity and separate backing. That entity really started with a more global strategy of where could we play with our skill set within the renewable space, where we could generate a private equity return. And we initially pursued two strategies. We took a slow approach to it, given we were new to the space. One was a solar royalty strategy, and one was a merchant battery strategy. On the solar royalty side, that was effectively buying parcels of land beneath operating solar farms or solar farms to be built. We love the asset class, the space. We spent a significant amount of time and effort putting together the processes to pursue these acquisitions, underwriting thoughts, how to capitalize them, what the exit market would look like. And we came away with very positive sentiment based on some of the initial feedback we got from solar farm owners. So we're not the developer. We just want to buy from the original ground owner. Ultimately, we decided to put that strategy on ice. And really, that's driven by interest rate costs. So interest rates have moved up by, call it, over 400 basis points from when we started looking at the strategy to today, yet the asset class hasn't changed in valuation. So we couldn't quite square with how those real estate costs haven't changed at all, despite the kind of economic backdrop in the backdrop of what's going on with interest rates. So when I say we put the strategy on ice, we really have. We plan to revisit that at least once we can say interest rates have stopped climbing, once there's some stability in interest rates, and see if there is a market reset in the valuations, or if there's not a market reset in the valuations after interest rates have been here at these elevated levels for a period of time, but also give us comfort that there's been, you know, price discovery and time for it to adjust to these current interest rates. On the resources side, we are the asset that we sold to Kimball, that largely was everything we bought from January 2019 through August of 2021. And everything, for the most part, that we bought from August 2021 to now, that's really setting up for our next sale. And when that would happen, we'll see. I mean, the asset portion of the asset could be ready sometime next year, but I think we're fairly patient in how we think about that, whether it's 12 to 36 month window of when we would come back to market. And why we didn't sell more assets beyond August 2021, it's really in the middle space. It was to, we put together a package that I thought, okay, here's a great package that we want whoever buys this, we want them to be excited to own it the day they buy it. And we want them 5 years down the road to say, hey, we're glad we bought the Hatch asset. It performed. And I think that's exactly the asset that we put together, an asset that we said, if we ran a public company, what would we want to buy? Something that has, you know, current yield, that's accretive to the public buyer, and it also has long-term growth. And that's everything that we believe this asset, you know, contributed. So we were really excited to sell that asset to Kimball, excited to take stock and be partners with Kimball, you know, for a period of time. So the transaction was cash and stock. And we just think really highly of the Kimball management team, Bob Davis and Rand and Brett. The whole team is just really fantastic.
No, awesome. Touching real quick. So when you're originally in Delaware and you expanded to Midland, because the Kimball asset was 90% Delaware, 10% Midland. So clearly you had bought heavily in the Delaware on the onset and started blending in Midland later on. Is this just to scale, expand opportunity? What's the impetus there?
Yeah, no, good question. So when we got started, the subsurface team, my partners, Andy Rotsky and Paul Fears, or reservoir and geo background respectively, were Delaware guys. They had spent, Andy had come from BHP out working in the Delaware Basin, and Paul had come from Carrizo, focused on Delaware Basin. So that's the area, one, I think from a subsurface perspective is the most challenging. So we felt like we had an edge from a operator mindset in that basin. And when we were transacting, we were just full out. I mean, we were stretched very thin as a small team with the deal activity that we were doing in 2019. We didn't have time to, I would say, underwrite the way we like to underwrite Midland Basin. We're a group that takes a lot of time on the front end studying and figuring out how we want to approach the business, how we want to underwrite the business. And then once we've done that, we think we're the fastest group out there. But we are definitely a let's measure twice, cut once group. And so when COVID hit, there was a slowdown in deal activity. Whether even if you had the capital to how did you underwrite when with where prices were trading? And so there was a several month period where, you know, we're not underwriting deals effectively. We're all, you know, I don't know, maybe we're all just staring at the ceiling, wondering what's going to happen in the oil and gas business. And we took that time to really take a deep dive into Midland Basin and really try to understand, you know, underwriting operator behavior. How do we get the predictability of the drill bit? I mean, buying minerals is fairly simplistic. It's pace and price. And so what we can spend a lot of time on is trying to figure out drilling pace. And then we do tail in obviously with a very deep dive on well spacing, EUR based on that well spacing, where should well spacing be? I mean, that's what really helped us in 2019 when people were drilling too tightly. We had already underwritten the basin on what well spacing should have been. Like if we were drilling those wells as an operator, where would we space those to really drive returns to the wellhead from an operator's perspective? That's how we underwrite. And so when well spacing widened up beyond post 2019, you know, that really matched our underwriting that we had already done. And wells continued the Delaware Basin to outperform. So actually outperformed our type curves. So then as we thought about Midland Basin coming out of or on the back half of COVID, we had taken that time to underwrite it, and we did want to cast a wider net. We liked the rock there. We still have trouble competing. There's just more competition in Midland Basin. I think there's more people that just underwrite on closeology versus true kind of subsurface understanding. So sometimes that's to our advantage. So sometimes whether it's Delaware or Midland Basin, that we can pay up a very high number and handily beat the competition. And sometimes, you know, because we feel like we know so much on the subsurface side that we can't get anywhere close. We can't even imagine how someone bought that deal. So it's, we love Midland Basin. We'd love to do more. And I think we definitely have done more, but we're still probably portfolio post Kimball is probably 15% Midland Basin right now.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagle Ford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. As a leading global energy business advisory firm, Opportune is well positioned to provide world-class technical, financial, and operational capabilities to minerals and royalties companies. Whether it's back office outsourcing, resource and reserve definition, land due diligence and administration, GIS mapping, valuation work, data and system integration, financial reporting, tax advisory, or buy and sell side assistance, Opportune LLP has got you covered. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Well, great. Well, I have all sorts of questions around 2020 to current on the buying front and the different dynamics around that. But, you know, you opened up talking about the Kimball deal. Let's just go ahead and break that down and kind of earmarked it from 2019 to August 2021. So the deal was announced on the 3rd of November for roughly $290 million. It was 90% Delaware, 10% Midland Basin. And then within that, kind of Texas, New Mexico, it was 82% Texas, Delaware, 8% New Mexico, Delaware. So just to give everyone listening a little bit of context, and it was 889 NRAs across 230,000 gross acres, pretty high NRI, about 0.8% average per tract. So that's the kind of high level overview. I'll hand it over to you. You guys built that portfolio. It sounds like you said, if we were a public, what we want to buy, reverse engineer really from point A to point B when you sold it, the buildup of the portfolio and how it developed and so on and so forth.
Sure. Yeah. So when we got started in early 2019, as we're underwriting different transactions, you know, the focus was on, you know, rock quality, operator quality, you know, pace. Can't control what commodity price is. We can't control pace, but we can do a good job of how we predict pace and how we evolve that model. And so as we were underwriting, the initial set of deals is whether it's a cash flow deal or non-cash flow deal, it underwrites. We've never been focused on price per net royalty acre. Unless someone wants us to make an offer on a price per net royalty acre, then we have to make sure that we're talking the same definition of net royalty acres. But otherwise, we put together an asset and really wanted to portfolio shape it. That's something that a yield buyer wanted to own and that it would continue to grow in production on average, you know, for a number of years. And we put together that portfolio. So some acquisitions that we did, you know, on an individual basis where, call it, you know, very low cash flow multiples that maybe we got lucky that a public didn't show up for that small one. And that's part of the ground game, being able to move fast, close fast, that we can take advantage of our size and speed, our smaller size and being very, very agile. A lot of the deals that we underwrite, right, might be the NAV works, but they're 50 times cash flow multiples, or they're 100 times cash flow multiples because that unit is largely undeveloped. And we have a view of it being contributing to a cash flow multiple buyer. You know, the buyers out there, yes, they want cash flow, but they also are looking at, you know, NAV. And the math is pretty simple. When you're putting together a company to be sold, ultimately, probably to a public, you can go look at where they trade and say, okay, what metrics are important to them on accretion? And so I think it was very clear that the publics that we talked to wanted accretion, you know, day one on the cash flow. So I think for the publics, we had growth accretion, you know, had higher growth than the publics, and they could put a valuation on us that was accretive day one to them. And that accretion would probably continue to grow over time, given our high growth. And so I think once we put together that formula, we thought there would be buyers, and we were very happy with the process and the competition in the process. And when you put together a differentiated asset package, people want to buy it.
The decision to go out to market, you know, did you feel like, $290 million is up there in size. Most market packages are, I don't know, 100 to 200 is kind of what you hear folks look to target, and they'll sometimes sell an undivided interest in a portfolio to keep it in that range. Why carve out the size you did, or did you build it to a certain size and then wait for it to develop to a certain profile to take it out to market? You know, the oil ran up over 100 and really kind of surged. Was it commodity pricing driven? Did you have a formula on, again, you're looking at, is the public going to buy it? The public start to come back in 2022. So did you feel like publics are the targets we want? We want to make sure that they're in the right position to be able to buy us versus, you know, they were on the sidelines and boxed out for a variety of reasons in kind of late 2020, early 2021, right? So all those different factors at play when you're getting to go to market, were there a couple leading indicators that said, hey, we're going to take this asset out now versus 6 months ago or 6 months in the future?
Yeah, the underlying is the asset has to have cash flow to be able to have a robust process if you want to take a deal out that has size to it like ours did. And kind of very early on, even in late 2019, as we were underwriting assets and we had, you know, already started to aggregate a nice portfolio, I would have thought that the sale timing was, you know, sometime fourth quarter 2022 or around then. So I think, and that really was driven not by some pre-formula, that was driven by when we thought the cash flow on the assets would start to ramp. And so as we went through the process of thinking about selling, we had more NRAs that we kept out of the sale. Some of those NRAs we kept out, one, because of the size, we didn't want to get too large. And two, there were assets that we'd bought recently that we didn't think would be a big contributor to the sale. Just if we bought something recently, it had no cash flow on it. You know, we don't buy assets. We're not out there buying assets that we think we buy day one, and the next day they're worth 2x of what we bought them from. That's never how we've underwritten. We take pace risk, calculated pace risk. And so when we buy something and we go beat competition on a deal, you know, we say, hey, look, we'll be right. We think we'll be right on a portfolio of assets 3 years down the line from here, or 4 years down the line, not in 6 months. That's never been our game. Yeah, sometimes we've been lucky and we buy something and it gets permitted up in 3 months. Sure, that happens. But as a portfolio, that's not really what we're trying to achieve. And so when we started talking to TPH, we looked at our asset profile and looked at what the current production was, LOS, where we thought the LOS production cash flow was going to be, and what made sense, what would be accretive to the different public buyers and private buyers day one. And when you look at that math, it's pretty simplistic to tell you when you should go out in a process. You know, we didn't want to be overdeveloped and we needed to have enough cash flow. So it's really finding that perfect mix of when your NAV value and your cash flow multiple value intersect, and there's plenty of meat on the bone, which that would tell you through the NAV. I think that's a great time to sell. And that's a great time for when the public should be buying. They don't have to take the risk of the pace risk, the same pace risk that we take when we buy something for 50 times cash flow multiple.
I don't know if this is a fair question, but as TPH takes this out the market, the data room opens up and you're starting to get offers in. Were you pleasantly surprised to see Kimball in the top of the running? I mean, I would argue that, you know, I have a pretty good pulse on the space. And if I was to look into the globe and predict the future, I wouldn't have guessed Kimball would have bought your portfolio. I would have thought it was too concentrated. And here we are. It goes to show you never know, but Kimball's just made two back-to-back Permian acquisitions, and they were previously coined as the diversified public, right? So when they got in there and were competitive, was that interesting to your team to see them in the running versus the logical Permian public is Sitio, right? Because they start as a pure play Permian company.
No, fair question. So I had a fairly close relationship with the Kimball management team. And when I was in banking, one of the very last transactions I worked on was their IPO. They had gone public ultimately after I had already left, but had spent a lot of time with Bob and Davis and the rest of the team. So just really had the utmost respect about how they think about the business, how they've capitalized the business, the type of acquisitions they've made. And I always kind of had them as a top buyer for us. But I'd say, Tim, to your point, I think there are other people based on their story might have said they're not going to be the buyer. I didn't, you know, who knows? You're always making a guess who the top buyer. And one of them, I really liked them. So I wanted them to be the top buyer or potentially be in the top of the heap there. So, you know, you cast a wide net in these processes to make sure you find the right person at the time, because there could be, if you could have another buyer that'd be a great buyer that's distracted because they're going through a transaction themselves, public or non-public. It could be a private entity that is raising money and they're not quite done raising money, that so they're out of your process. So you never know who's going to be the right buyer. I mean, even if you come up with a list and say, here's the top 10 most logical buyers or top five logical buyers, you know, even if you take my asset today and you say, okay, 2 years from now, if we go through another asset sale, those top five logical buyers today might have changed, you know, 2 years from today or 2 years from now, two of them are that should be the top buyers are out and that just for that particular moment. But if you waited 6 months, they would have been the top buyer. You never know. That's why you have good bankers like TPH help you kind of run that process, and they have a good pulse on what people are buying in the market. And we think it was a phenomenal asset for Kimball. We think it was a great value for them. And we think the Cibolo acquisition was another great acquisition that they made as shareholders in Kimball. We were really excited to see that acquisition that they made. And we looked at that acquisition and underwrote ourselves and think it was a great deal for the Kimball shareholders and management team to make.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned your shareholders. Obviously, the transaction was part stock and part cash. The split of the 290 was $150 million to cash and then about $140 million in common units of Kimball. Walk me through, you're with TPH, you're starting to get offers and you're evaluating the alternatives on the table. There's going to be offers that might have a debt component, right? And so there's a rising interest rate environment. How does that affect things? All cash offers, all paper, a mix. You ended up going with a mix. And now once there's an equity component in there, walk me through kind of the thought process from that point on, because where I'm getting at is, you know, there's an inherent challenge with Minerals Publics, and that's there's this ongoing appetite to scale, right? And the folks that are doing a great job of building institutionally investable portfolios are private equity. But then when you acquire private equity backed portfolios, you get private equity overhang phenomena, and it's a challenge, right? And so there could be a great relationship between the public and the private equity sponsor. You know, it's not like the stock is being dumped day one, but you know, there's just a challenge there because over time the private equity sponsor is going to want to drip out, and that typically trades the stock down a little bit. And this has happened with Kimball in the past, right? I think what's interesting about Kimball is they're one of the few publics to actually start with no private equity, but they've acquired a bunch of companies, all with private equity, so they've gotten a lot of private equity into, you know, their shareholder base. And then as the shareholder base is, they've kind of been more balanced and replaced some of the private equity with retail. Their stock has rebounded really nicely. This happened a couple of years ago, I think, after the Springbok acquisition. And so just knowing this is very much a possibility and has indeed, you know, the stock has traded down since y'all's transaction. How do you guys weigh that internally? Is it clearly you have a good relationship with Kimball? So is it just believing in the Kimball story and knowing public markets are public markets, and it's again a long-term play just as a public shareholder now? Just over to you to break all that, the mental exercise down.
Yeah, no, fair question. I think one, it does start with having the close relationship with the Kimball management team, and two, we're long-term owners of mineral assets. And that in the transaction, both cash and stock achieved that. So specifically to Kimball, the stock has traded down since we sold, but we've also gotten a 48 cent distribution last quarter. I think they've announced a 35 cent distribution for the next quarter. So we're very happy with the yield component of the story. And we are fine with being patient on the story. We, you know, the management team, you know, starts with quality management team. So I've seen the management team, you know, known them for a long time, seen how they operated, seen how they've acquired assets, very high trust factor with the performance. In my personal opinion, they have a bulletproof balance sheet. And they've shown that they get the type of acquisitions a public minerals company should be making through our acquisition and through the Cibolo acquisition. They're patient acquirers. They don't feel like they have to go make acquisitions, but when the acquisition makes sense, they put together an offer. And if offer's accepted, they close on it. It makes it very easy to deal with the transaction, to get a transaction done with a counterparty where the trust factor is high, where you know there's going to be follow through. And so, you know, there's another story. They have bought a lot of different private equity backed companies. And those private equity backed companies, the ones that wanted to stay in have been able to stay in, and the ones that have wanted to sell over time have been able to get out. So there's lots of different reasons why that transaction and very specific to Kimball of why we were willing to take Kimball stock. And I think, you know, that would just have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis for different counterparties. But we were very pleased with taking the Kimball stock.
Okay. No, I appreciate you answering that. Well, great. Listen, again, congratulations to your team on the exit. Congrats to KRP. And again, on their Cibolo acquisition recently, which was $140 million. That was announced in April. So another Permian acquisition, another step towards scaling. So well done to them. Let's circle back August 2021 onwards. You guys have been building another portfolio. So let's dive into that, you know, what the portfolio looks like today and everything. But I'd like to peel it back a few more layers and really get into the weeds with you. So you guys, I've been by and large a Delaware player. Let's go back to 2020. I think what's interesting is when you look at New Mexico, the drilling moratorium comes out when Biden gets elected, and there is just a ton of permits that hit the market. Now, I just had Casey Stallings on the podcast, and I asked him about this, and he said, it's really interesting because what it showed us at the time was where not to buy in New Mexico. That was their spin on it. And now we have 3 years of education looking back at that big pile of permits that got put out there. What was New Mexico like for you guys? And how do you look at New Mexico today and just the aftermath of everything? Obviously, it's some of the best rock in the world, and the moratorium threat and fears of oil and gas being banned there is, I don't think, prevalent anymore. But over to you, New Mexico, last 3 years, break it down.
Yeah, no, happy to. We agree. We love the rock in New Mexico, and do they get some of the best rock in the basin? Early on, as we thought about New Mexico, you know, we had concerns about being fed acreage. We had concerns about pace predictability, given just how people collected permits and the time to convert those permits and the number of permits that never got converted. First predictability in Texas, Delaware. And then you have the drilling moratorium talk come out with a new administration that obviously provided a lot of worry on our front. So we bought in New Mexico. We really tried to avoid Fed, which is a challenge if you're buying in New Mexico. So the deals that we bought were really kind of more in that small fee window. We had a few deals that were Fed override, but I mean, just a minuscule amount was in the Fed acres. That view has changed. We would be much more willing to buy in Fed acres today. And really that is, you know, just as we focus on Texas, Delaware first, then we really got a subsurface view and a pace view of Midland Basin. We're going through that process right now with New Mexico. So this portfolio is going to skew a slightly higher percent of it by the time we're done with it than the last portfolio that we sold, if the deals are there. I think before we actively avoided federal overrides in New Mexico, unless it was something that already had ducks on it effectively, or permits that we had a differentiated view that really was going to get converted and had screened out the permits that were old or too tightly spaced, et cetera. So buying in New Mexico is very different than buying in Texas, though. I mean, it's just a different BD effort. It's a different network of landmen that are very active in that area. There's different diligence that you have to go through in that process. It's a little bit of a different animal, but we love the rock, and we are...
Explain that a little further, because this is one of my questions on the broker network. So when you're looking at New Mexico versus Texas on the Delaware side, are the broker dynamics a bit different, or just the kinds of deal flow different, or is it fairly similar?
It's just finding out which brokers that you work well with, you know, which ones, you know, is there a strong line of communication, you know, once they get comfort that in certain areas that we're going to be aggressive, or in their mind, aggressive in terms of valuations. And so they can get a deal done. That, look, they want to go and a surety of getting something done and get something done quickly. These deals, you know, once you discover a willing seller in a particular unit, they don't last long. You know, you're not contacting anyone that hasn't been contacted, you know, dozens of times in the last, you know, several months, probably. So being able to move quickly, and as we kind of develop those relationships, develop where we want to pay up. But it's really, you know, we have our own proprietary network of brokers and how we proprietary view and how we do mailers and how we tail in with brokers. And it's harder to develop that process in New Mexico. We're going through that right now, going through that process to pursue it when you just don't have the mineral appraisals like you do in Texas. And so you have to spend some kind of real title diligence dollars ahead of a calling or broker program or mailing program in New Mexico versus how Texas, Delaware works. And so I think it's look, we've always been so full in activity between Texas and Delaware and Midland Basin that we haven't had the bandwidth to pursue, you know, at scale, a New Mexico plan. We have hired more people and we've improved kind of our people infrastructure and how we think about how we pursue acquisitions, and added, you know, a couple of minerals analysts that help us do land work. There was a lot of activity, you know, where our subsurface team was doing probably half land work and half kind of subsurface underwriting work. And so really we've taken that land work off their shoulders and given it to people that are really good at doing land each and every day and cleaning it up for the subsurface team to evaluate. So we had between managing brokers, managing our own broker network and mailers and closing deals, our land group was completely taxed. Our subsurface group was completely taxed doing land work for BDA deals that need to be underwritten. And so really figuring out how we staff that right. You know, maybe we've been overly cautious on growing people-wise. And I think we feel like we're in a really good spot to be able to expand into New Mexico and do it the way that we've underwritten Midland and Texas, Delaware.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Need energy industry management experience at your fingertips? Opportune LLP, a leading global energy business advisory firm, has the capabilities needed to overcome your minerals and royalties team's technical, operational, and financial challenges. To learn more, search Opportune's podcast E2B, Energy to Business, on Apple and Spotify Podcasts, where Opportune examines emerging financial and technology trends and provides a broad perspective on ways to stay ahead, create opportunities, and execute market strategies. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
And I've always viewed you guys as a ground game shop. You know, like you said, you like to think you move quicker than anyone. Measure twice, cut once, as you say. Maybe in New Mexico, you measure three times, cut once, with a little extra diligence up front.
Yes.
Would you say most of your deal flow is coming from your ground game? Are you doing anything up market? Do you see opportunities for consolidation amongst, call it, your mid-size aggregators, the $5 to $15 million portfolios? Are you doing anything creative? I mean, you're a finance guy by background. As interest rates get crazy, maybe there's some price volatility going forward, you know, reversionary or, you know, step out, earn out deals, right? Have you done any of that to date, or it's really just been elbow grease, grinding, and just, you know, one a bunt and a single at a time, and then the runs add up?
Definitely the latter. Elbow grease, singles, bunts, and then when a big deal comes, that, you know, we're ready to move. So whether it's a you know, we take a $200,000 deal as serious as we take a $2 million or $20 million deal. And we're very competitive. We like to win good deals that underwrite makes sense. We haven't had to do any of the revisionary work. We've never done partner up with an operator to look at drill schedules. We had an operator a while back ask us to do that. Kind of view is, well, I already know where you're going. So I don't, and not because I have any proprietary information. You know, we have proprietary information we've generated ourselves about what makes most logical sense. Like the operator's going to go where they have infrastructure and returns. And so when we looked at drilling predictability, that's really kind of led us for each of the operators. Not saying that we wouldn't. I mean, we certainly would look at those relationships if it made sense to us. So it is, you know, we do the old KISS, keep it simple, stupid. And that seems to work. And so we're going to keep using the elbow grease and focus on singles until it stops working. And it's been working really well for us. And I'd say that the market has been really attractive recently for acquisitions. I mean, look, it's not without risk. You know, we're acquiring, you've had more oil volatility. You have, heavily backwardated strip, which means the market predicts that oil prices are going to be falling here quickly. And you're heading into, this kind of murky economic backdrop. But, I think as us having patience and having a really good sponsor that's patient with us, if we just like when we bought 2019, we had no one predicted COVID in 2020. And, we battened down the hatches and bought deals that made sense and stayed patient and waited for production to grow. So it had nothing to do with oil price or just production said it was ready to be sold. And then the market was ready for it at the same time. So we took it to market. And that's the same thing that we're doing here. We're going to continue to aggregate. And if we hit a part of the market that looks like we've overpaid for assets, like everyone thought in 2020, minerals assets, high margin, very attractive. And if you can pick your time when you sell within a reasonable time frame, it's a great asset to own and own through cycles.
What are your views on the rising cost of debt and its impact on the Permian deal flow landscape? What opportunities does it create for Hatch, you think? I mean, my mind goes to, I always say this, right? Hey, Tim, do a lot of guys use debt in minerals? No, it's not really an asset class that uses a lot of debt. But then when you actually start talking to folks, whether it's small lines of credit, blending in debt to stretch your dollars on an acquisition, although it's modest leverage, it leverages use pretty extensively. And a lot of guys who, fundraising is challenging. They start brokering, they get a little bit of a track record. They think, I'm going to raise some capital, I'm going to raise a fund. And it's difficult. So what they end up doing is building a war chest and then using that as collateral to get a line of credit to stretch their dollars and start doing some deals and take down bigger pieces on their own. That can create opportunity, can also put them in a tight spot when commodity prices drop significantly and they have to pay down that debt. And so I think there's a great opportunity for roll-up. I think a lot of assets are going to shake loose here in the next 12 months if interest rates stay this high for another year or so, particularly in the Haynesville. But over to you, just given your background, how do you see all the different and the economic backdrop you're talking about being murky going forward? How's it all fit together to create opportunity?
On the debt piece, the publics have all really been focused on having very, very conservative balance sheets. We're talking about around 1x leverage, for such a high margin business like owning minerals with so much cash flow on it, they can really pay down their debt really quickly. They need to get down to 0x. Depending on how much they're going to pay out to shareholders. On our end, we use leverage, and whether we use leverage or don't use leverage, it doesn't change how we underwrite or how acquisitive we are. We don't bake in leverage returns on anything that we do. We look at everything on an equity underwriting. And if it works on an equity underwriting, yes, having leverage can help. Obviously, where leverage costs are now, it doesn't help as much. You start to get really expensive. So leverage doesn't have any impact on what we'll do or not do. It never has, but it might create some of those smaller deals where someone was able to, whether it's just getting leverage. So maybe these smaller mineral buyers, raising capital is tough. And in this market, it's really tough. So whether it's debt capital, they can't find a bank that might provide them debt in this backdrop. And then if they do, the interest rate costs really squeeze them. But them just trying to find equity dollars too makes it really challenging. So there might be more people willing, instead of closing on a $2 million or $5 million deal, you know, partnering with us and working with us and selling to us. Yes, we pride ourselves on the ground game, but we pride ourselves on buying deals wherever they're available. If it's a ground game, we love ground game, and that's where we get the most of our deals done. But we take, if someone brings us a deal and we've worked with that person, we want that person to come away happy with us, whether, and we can't always guarantee we'll be the top buyer for them, but we want to always give them a quick answer. So, hey, if you want to get a deal done with us, how quickly do you need to know? It's an hour. Okay, give us an hour and we'll give you an answer. And so if you decide we're not the right partner, you can move on quickly and try to go do a deal with someone else, which I think they appreciate. And then when we do get a deal done with them, they see how easy it is, you know, to close a deal, how quickly we can do it. And so we get trying to set up a lot of repeat, you know, transactions with the same kind of broker network that's kind of outside of our proprietary broker network.
Yeah. So that's a great segue really to close out the episode. So if someone's listening today, they feel like they're drumming up good deals, they haven't done a deal with you guys yet. I mean, it sounds like you're a great partner, and answer in an hour or two. If I'm moving a deal, that's great, right? Because time, especially if you're trying to do a simultaneous close or something, it gets really tricky with timing. So for the folks who are bringing you deals, you know, I think the challenge is, if there's no relationship there, how do you get moved up to the front of the pipeline versus being put in the back burner? What are the things that are, you know, immediate, it adds hair to it and it makes it more challenging for you guys, or some pet peeves? And what are some things you really like? Let's just help both sides here. Hatch to get more deal flow, and those listening to get deals done with you guys, what they can do to have everyone benefit in the process.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, Tim. Well, first it's get to know Heath Thompson, who ends up land for Hatch, and you'll see him, you know, posting on LinkedIn for Hatch. And Heath does a great job of canvassing the market and keeping those relationships close. But we're always surprised by how many new people he can meet that maybe reach out to us on a random info@hatchres.com email. And they're like, wow, sometimes there's even someone in Austin. We've been here since 2019 do this. So we're always happy to meet kind of new people working on transactions within the middle space. But really it's, you know, it takes time to build up that trust. But if someone comes to us and treats us like partners and just is upfront, if they want to come and say, hey, I've got a deal, be upfront about where they are in the process. You know, we know everyone's trying to make money in this business. We're fine with that. If you want to say, hey, I've got a deal, it's not under contract, I'm showing it to three people and I need an answer in 24 hours. Or if you give me an answer today, if you hit this number, it's yours, but I don't have it signed up yet. I mean, just be upfront about where it is in the process. We understand these deals are hard to get. And I think it helps us formulate kind of where it goes in the stack. You know, if people come to us and say, hey, I've got a deal and I've got it locked up, and it turns out they don't got it locked up, or they can't deliver it to us, you know, next time they bring us one, it's probably not going to be taken too seriously. We understand deals fall apart. So that's why if we kind of know the full picture and it falls apart, hey, it falls apart. And there's obviously, we don't have a change of view of someone for not landing a deal that they said they didn't have yet, or they thought there was only a 50-50 shot of getting it. So I think transparency is always helpful. I know typically people don't want to be transparent, worry we're not going to go around anyone. But someone brings us a deal, if we're already looking at the deal, already have direct contact, we'll let the person know. We'll never go around someone, even if they're, you know, even if it was, yeah, you know, we'd rather cut them in, even if it perceived to look like we were going around them. So just upfront transparency, I think, is the name of the game, to work really closely with us. And look, if you're coming to try to make your retirement money on just one deal with us and make this gigantic spread, you know, look, if it underwrites, we'll buy it, but I'd rather do 50 deals with you than one deal with you.
No, well said. There's just too much volume in this space to be short-sighted. If in any industry, relationships matter, in minerals, they really matter, right? So echo everything you said. Appreciate you sharing that. Last thing, just, will you look at white space deals? Is it that right development mix? I mean, you've already said 200,000 to 20 plus million. So clearly size is not an impediment. You'll look at anything in terms of size, but is there a certain thing you like right now that you're willing to get a little more aggressive on?
Yeah, I mean, I think we love white space deals in the right white space deal. And those where we can get, and some of those we can get really aggressive. And we've probably looked at every white space deal out there. So as someone else in a particular track comes to sell, we've probably already underwritten it and can give you a really quick view on it. And I think we can be very upfront, like, hey, this is a deal we really want. Again, this is not a real estate business, and people really boil this down to these price per net roll ticker multiples, which I think are completely meaningless. The best deals we've done, but if you want to put it on a real estate multiple, you know, the best deals we've done have ones where we have paid over 40,000 net roll ticker, hands down, all day long. Those are the type of deals that when we hear that's the price discovery, I'd say that's usually a predictor. There's a better chance that we're going to get a deal done than someone bringing us a deal and saying, hey, it's 8,000 net roll ticker. We'll do 8,000 net roll ticker deals if they underwrite. I'm not saying that. It's just we have a view that we like to be, you know, truly in the best acres. And we have a differentiated view on what those best acres truly are worth. And so we're willing to pay good numbers for the best white space deals.
Awesome. No, interesting perspective there, just viewing the world very differently, you know, from an operator's eye set. And so the neurology, like you said, sometimes it plays your advantage and disadvantage on winning deals when guys are doing the neurology and the real estate mentality, but it is what it is.
But, right? But we love cash flow deals too. So people shouldn't take away that we want to look at cash flow deals. We look at process deals. Yeah. Like we get blown out. And every time someone gets beat, they say, oh, well, someone else is overpaying. Well, no, it just might be, they've got a differentiated view, or it works in their portfolio different than, or their timing is different. I mean, it's really attractive. If you go buy a bunch of deals that have, that are white space deals, buying a deal that has a lot of cash flow on the front end that you can reinvest is really attractive, even if your returns are squeezed because they're so much attractive. So, because the cash flow is so attractive, and you blend that all in a portfolio, it works.
Yep. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Glad you came back on, my friend. Appreciate your time. If there's anything we missed, let me know. Otherwise, looking forward to catching you in person soon. And best of luck to you, Heath, and the team on continuing to grow the portfolio.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. Always a pleasure. If it's 3 years from now when we do our next one, hopefully we have another good update or a sale by then.
Yeah. Thanks. Hopefully I still have hair by then. for the next 3 year update.
But we all hope for that.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks. See ya.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.